It's great to have your company. You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. My name's Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Well, science versus religion is a very old chestnut, though perhaps not as old as many people think. Today it's easy to imagine that you can either put your hope in science or in religion. Well, Tom McLeish is a professor of physics at Durham University, and he's written a book called Faith and Wisdom in Science. And he thinks that history, theology, and science have plenty to say to each other today and into the future. Tom's in the studio. Welcome, Tom.
Good to be here, Simon. Hello.
Now, I might, I might regret asking you this. It's a pretty long answer, possibly, but tell us very quickly, what's your research about?
So I'm a soft matter theoretical physicist. So the soft bit will amuse you. So for many years I've looked at the physics, what the molecules and atoms are doing in soft, squidgy, slimy stuff, including hot plastics. So we've worked with industry for a number of years on that, for example.
When we ask a physicist about his research, we don't really expect to understand what they're saying.
Do you understand
in response.
That?
I did understand
that. There we are.
But you're a big believer that science is something that everyone can appreciate.
Yeah, absolutely. That, in fact, the reason I wrote the book actually is not so much about the science and religion issue, although it came to be that. It's because as a scientist, I've become really upset that science is something for most people so distant, something they feel they can't enjoy. It was difficult when they were at school, didn't get the hang of it. It's all techie. And I think it's like music or art or dancing or drama or painting. It's one of those sorts of things that actually everyone can enjoy it to some extent. We're working with biologists now too. I've got fascinated by what happens when physics works with biology and looks at what's going on in cells. Yeah.
I'm one of those people that found science rather difficult at school,
well,
so I'm encouraged. Now, I want to just ask you quickly, what made you, as a younger person, want to get into this? What brought you into the scientist world?
Oh, well, I can't remember a time when I wasn't a scientist in some ways as a little boy. You know, it was, we're talking the late 60s here, unfortunately. but the whole moonshot race, I had a little telescope when I was a little boy. In fact, my grandmother gave me a little microscope that her grandfather had. You know, a 19th century naturalist, a field microscope, beautiful mahogany case, brass thing. And I used to look at little swimming bugs from ponds and flies' wings and beautiful plant cells in leaves. I remember and made a little book for myself. And you know, so I did that as a kid, so I knew I was... And the very word experiment made me go all sort of shivery, all tingly all over. I remember when I was quite little.
Sounds like you were destined to be a scientist, really.
Well, I don't know about that.
But then physics, I mean, as you say, you also are interested in the biology, you're working with biologists, but you also work on the history of science. Why do you care about that, about the history side of this?
Yeah, I think it's a rather human thing. I mean, I think we're all interested in our roots, aren't we? People are fascinated by cavemen and early men, where humans came from, and then people do family trees, don't they? And they want to know, you know, when their great-grandparents emigrated or if they're, you know, from that sort of family background. We all like our background. I think actually science could do more about that. We don't teach students very well about where ideas come from. If we're going to find out new ideas in the future, I always think it's a good idea to learn from the past. You know, what were the blind alleys? What were the alluring ideas that didn't work? Where did science come from? And the other reason I'm really interested in science is the human side of things, because we tend to project science as something exclusively modern. You know, science comes along in the 16th, 17th centuries and blows away all those millennia and centuries of darkness and oppression and ignorance and stuff. And I was always suspicious of that story because I guess, you know, I've always, in science, things happen gradually. So one thing that I've found is that the thing that we call science, when you go right back into history, and I mean medieval centuries, the late antiquity, the church fathers, for example, or of course all the way back to ancient Greek, science is a strand that has been part of humanity forever.
So you're actually working alongside medieval historians and theologians on specific project at the moment. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Do you want to hear about that? It's my favourite interdisciplinary wacky project at the moment. So very Durham. So Durham, if those of you listeners who've ever been to Europe and been to see Durham, do come tomorrow. It's a jewel, medieval jewel, big castle and cathedral from the 11th century. Students live in a medieval castle, some of them, when they come to Durham University. They think it's great in the summer. And when winter comes, they realise maybe it wasn't such a great idea. But it's a privilege being in a place with so many centuries of scholarship. Yeah, so Giles Gaspar, my friend and senior lecturer in history, and I got together over some 13th centuries, the 1220s, some manuscripts and treatises written by a guy called Robert Grosseteste, who was an early teacher to the Oxford Franciscans. He later became Bishop of Lincoln, 1235. But he wrote, as many people did then, little articles, treatises on light, colour, sound, the motion of the celestial bodies. And I thought, well, let's see what happens when scientists and the humanities scholars read this together. I mean, at a very naive level, we need the medieval scholars because they're written in Latin, and then the Latin is written in a really extraordinary, texty, sort of abbreviated way. So you've got to have this discipline called paleography to understand even what the Latins say. Then you have to translate it. But we found that this is really quite deep, mathematically thought out stuff. And the humanities commentaries hadn't really picked all this up in the past. So by working together with scientists today and medieval scholars, we're finding that there's some really crucial stuff going on. For example, a three-dimensional theory of colour. I mean, we know today colour has these three qualities. You know, red, green, blue on our computer screens gets us all the colour. Grosseteste knew this and wrote it down why it is. And we've had to delicately look at his theory of the rainbow. And we've done some calculations just to convince us that what he says is correct. And this has spun off some science papers. So one of the lovely things about this project is that not only are we producing better editions and translations and commentaries on this amazing Latin medieval science, every time we do it, we spin out a science paper. And the humanities scholars get to be authors on that. We've published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society, all sorts of things. So you can see why I'm excited about that project.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity, and we're speaking with Professor Tom McLeish, who's a physics professor at the University of Durham. Now, Tom, you are also a Christian as well as a physicist, and that might surprise some people. How do your fellow scientists respond to the idea that you have faith?
Some find it a bit odd, but I have to say, people are asking me, do my fellow scientists at the Royal Society, my fellow, for example, or in the physics department at Durham, find it odd? Well, actually, I have to say mostly they don't. I think maybe in the UK we're fortunate, apart from one or two very public examples, of course, most people understand that one needs to make a step of faith in either direction. I mean, when it comes to the existence of God, it's not obvious prima facie that there isn't a God, and there's not, for us, prima facie evidence that he is. But I tend to approach worldview in much the same way, with the same mind I approach science. Look, for me, as a young man, I decided that I was impressed by Christianity because it had the best explanation for many, many things, including the existence of what we call evil and the outrage. This is an unusual way into Christianity, but I found that an atheist secularism didn't really have a satisfying account for the outrage that we feel about things that are bad. And, of course, then you have questions of where does this unreasonable thing called hope come from? And you know, physicists are we're used to a mindset, we're used to thinking along the lines of, well, there's no smoke without fire. If there's gravity around you, well, there's mass somewhere, okay? If there's an electric field, there's a charge somewhere. But if there's smoke, there's something emitting little particles of matter somewhere. So in moving into the human sphere, if there's hope, well, there's a source for it somewhere. If there's love, there's a source for it somewhere. So, you know, it's not a knockdown argument, but it seemed to me perfectly reasonable, rational to go on from there into exploring the Bible, exploring the life of prayer, exploring the history of the church, of philosophy, and in fact, as this organization does, what does the world look like when you light it up with a belief of God? For me, theology isn't the study of God. I don't think God's an object that you can put in a box and study. But theology for me is the study of everything else in the light of God. And so I'm always asking myself, what does the world look like under the light of the existence of God and a God who's become incarnate and loves his world? And for me, Christianity and my experience of Christianity has lit the world up in a helpful, consistent and challenging way that no other worldview does. So, you know, it feels like science in some ways, and science sits within it.
I'm interested in what that then does for your science. So the yeah. world lit up with the sense of the presence of God.
Right.
What does that do when you're doing when you're doing your science?
It's that's interesting because this really hit me when I was reading writing the book. One of the reasons that people find science difficult and distant and we have difficulties with it is because we've lost the plot around science. I mean, in our society, human beings, socially, we don't know what science is for. Well, I mean, governments will say that we fund science because we can invent new things and make money from it, and that's true, but it's not the whole story by any means. Why do we have this innate curiosity into the universe, and how on earth are human minds able to understand the behavior of the atom, the swirling black holes in the hearts of distant galaxies, the early first few seconds of the universe, the tiny processes of information in the cell of a tiniest plant nucleus. How on earth do we do that, and why do we spend so much time doing it? That's what I wanted to discover. I wanted to find a story for science. I also wanted to find it politically, because we, I don't know if you've noticed, but we get stuck on scientific questions publicly. I mean, I don't need to list them, but climate change, fracking. People don't know how to have adult conversations about these things. And all these were clues to me that we needed to know what science is for. Now, purpose is a bad word these days. There, in a university campus like mine, not many disciplines will smile at you if you start asking questions about what things are for. But actually, there is one humanities discipline that's okay talking about purpose, and that's theology. Now, the point is that theology can, of course, do things for believers, but I think theology is a contributory humanities discipline for the secular world as well. I think we can learn things from the theology, whatever our belief is. So my faith helped me illuminate a theology of science. I realized we could move beyond the confrontational battleground. Is it theology or faith or science? I increasingly believe that's a non-question. To let's situate science in the deeply human story, which is illuminated by theology or from ancient times, and ask, are there clues there that we can use practically today to discover again what science is for at a deeply human and social and public level? So that's how I'd, that's a long answer to your question, but that's how I'd answer that question.
So what does that look like, Tom? You talk about a grassroots theology of science, yeah, don't you? What does that mean?
I think this point was made by a number of 20th century writers actually have talked about it. And actually, so does Robert Grosseteste, so does my medievalist as well. So people like George Steiner and Hannah Arendt, and even the postmodernists have talked about this gulf. Steiner says, talks about the inhuman otherness of matter. Arendt also talks about the gap. There's a sort of gap between human beings and the world we live in, where we're frightened of nature, we're frightened of what it hurts us, we're frightened of darkness, we're uncomfortable in time. Time always is flowing too quickly, too slowly for us. Well, why? It's like a fish complaining about the water. There's something about the human condition, which if you think about it, is very surprising. We're not comfortable in our own skin. Now, Steiner talked about this and talked about it in the context of art. And I remember reading something he said in a lovely book called Real Presences. He says, only art can go some way towards reconciling us to waking into some measure of commensurability, he says, the sheer inhuman otherness of matter. And I've never forgotten reading those beautiful words, because I thought, thank you, Professor Steiner, for showing me or giving me a clue as to what science might be for. You know, if there's a job to do in making friends with nature, then it seems to me that science is a wonderful toolkit or bridge-building kit to do that. Then I started digging back into both the history of philosophy. People like our medievalist had an explicit theology for why they were doing science. Christianity has a story for why we're fish out of water. It talks about sin. That has all sorts of connotations for people. But what that really means is the way that we've walked away from our responsibilities to the world, if you like. That's what it is. So if there's a gap, who moved? Grosseteste talks about using our senses to look into the world, now in obedience to a God who's reached out to us in Jesus. That's, you know, let's mend this relationship. So it begins to look like mending a broken relationship. So the theology of science, or the story that I've got to so far, may change in future, but I think it's practical, useful, makes sense, and has all sorts of exciting consequences, is that science is the tool that we have to do the job of making friends with nature, of mending this broken relationship with nature.
Well, that's a beautiful picture, Tom. I sort of wish you'd been my Year 8 science teacher. That's about when it started to go badly for me. So much more we could talk about there, Tom, but we'll have to leave it. But thanks so much for coming in.
Great. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks, both of you.
You've been listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. For more on this topic and many more, go to publicchristianity.org.